Hi, everybody. This is Masonic Central, and this is Sunday, November 30th of 2008. We're at our special early time of 2 p.m. on Sunday. This is the talk show for Freemasons by Freemasons, hosted to explore the depths of the Masonic world. If you're new to our program, visit our website, MasonicCentral.com, and send us an email at MasonicCentral@gmail.com and let us know what you think. If you have a question or if you want to propose something to us and we read it on the air, we'll send you out some goodies to say thank you for sending it. Also on our website, you can find our calendar, which has our upcoming guests. We're running out of guests for this year, but look for us next year. We're going to try to fill that puppy up and get lots of good things coming to you. Just a little bit of a disclaimer that this show is representative of the contents of the contributors and the hosts, myself and Dean Kennedy, and does not represent any opinion of any regular or irregular Masonic body or Grand Masonic Lodge. Further, that this show does not have a particular agenda, nor is it a recruitment tool for any particular body, rite, or system of degrees of Freemasonry. My name is Greg Stewart. I host a couple of websites and blogs in this show, and this is my fellow host, Dean Kennedy. How you doing, Dean?
I'm great, Greg. Thanks for asking. You're so white today. What's up with that?
It must be that it's early today. I know we're 4 hours earlier than what we normally do, and it's good to see that we have a bit of an audience here joining us. And I'm doing good, though. I'm doing good. Anything exciting in our mailbag this week? I know we got a few emails there.
We did get a few, and I'm going to mention one right off the bat. Was from a fellow Brother Al up in Glasgow, Scotland, wrote and said that he usually downloads our show on Monday evenings because he can't make the 2 a.m. at his time zone when we're taping live. But hopefully, I sent him an email about an hour ago to tell him this was on tonight, and hopefully he'll join us tonight. But Al, if you're downloading this and listening to this tomorrow, have a great day, and we enjoy having you listening to our show. And well, that's what
that's
we like
great.
To do.
You know, just showing our shows reaching a broader audience abroad. That's great. I know we got
last
a couple
week
of
we
other
had a guy from Tokyo calling, emailing us, right? So this is great.
Further
and we also looked at the stats of the show of people coming through our website, and we're seeing a lot of people in South Africa as well. So I'd like to say hello to all the guys out in South Africa that are listening to us as well. We didn't expect to have such an international following, but here we are.
It's surprising, isn't it? It's surprising the reach that this medium can have across the globe. It's really cool. But yeah, we got a couple of other interesting emails also. I wanted to acknowledge them and give a nod to them that we did receive them and we've read them. Because of the short window this week, though, we'll definitely get to it in the future. One of them proposed a rather interesting question that I think that we can definitely come to in a future show and look at it more in a perspective of a lodge etiquette rather than the challenge that we were put to with it. You know, nobody likes being challenged, but we're definitely up for it, and we'll definitely look into it. So for that little bit of mystery, everybody keep your eyes open for it, and we'll maybe have some interesting dialogue coming up in the future. Slow week here in the States. We had a holiday here, as all those listening from the 50 states here know Thanksgiving. So thanks for joining us again with the short notice on the show and for being here on this end of the holiday weekend. This week, as those who follow the calendar, we have a special guest coming to us from abroad. We have a guest coming to us from England. Her name is Pip Fox, and she is the co-author with Bob Davis of the book The Masonic Magician, The Life and Death of Count Cagliostro and the Egyptian Rite. How are you doing today, Pip?
Hi, good evening. I'm doing fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for joining us here this week. I know the time change, we shifted around a little bit, and I'm glad that we're able to get into an hour that was still good for you and have you on the show. Tell us about this book. How did you come to write a book about this fellow named Cagliostro?
Right. Well, it's a rather strange story, really. Basically, I mean, my husband's a Freemason of quite a few years, and when I started writing, we were kind of trying to find a really exciting quest-style book to write, and he said, well, hey, why don't you write about a chap? He's called Cagliostro. They don't know much about him. He was a Freemason and had a bit of a bad press. So I thought, yeah, okay. And I began to research into it. And I was talking to Bob on the phone, my co-author, and he said, "Oh, I think we've actually got a manuscript by this guy in the library of the Grand Lodge of Scotland." And sure enough, he got back to me and confirmed that there was indeed this ritual kept within the library. And he got rather excited and said, "Would I mind co-authoring?" And so I said, "Yeah, fine." And it went from there. So what started with just an inkling of an idea turned into sort of, you know, some good luck that he happened to have this ancient ritual handy.
Now, I guess it's important to note, we had a Bob Davis here on the show a few weeks ago. He was from Guthrie, Oklahoma. Bob Davis, he is the, is he the Grand Secretary or the historian for the Grand Lodge of England? Or not England, of Scotland.
Yeah, it's Bob Cooper, actually.
Cooper, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
What am I thinking?
Okay. yeah, he's the curator of the Library and Museum at the Grand Lodge in Scotland.
And so with this manuscript, this was a document that they had had for some time and that had just been residing there, and the interest of it within this book came up in the sense of your conversation with him. Had there really been much research on him prior to your tackling this task?
Well, once I got into looking into him, I realised that there had been quite a lot written about him, but he'd had such a bad press. He'd been painted as a real kind of charlatan and fraudster. And this has filtered down through the past 200 years, really. And then around about the beginning of the 1900s, a couple of guys started to write about him that shed a completely different light on him, and began to look further into his Masonic life and also his sort of magical path. But I mean, it was amazing that, you know, Bob happened to just have a look through the catalogue to the library and saw this and then spoke to me a couple of weeks later, and it kind of clicked into place. So, yeah, I mean, he's fairly well documented throughout history, but like I said, you know, it was all fairly negative press.
Just from a few of the excerpts from the book, one of them was a jewel heist, of all things. Or I guess not really so much a heist, but a roll of duplicity in the Queen's jewels.
Oh, yeah, that was basically, it was called The Affair of the Diamond Necklace. And it was around about 4 or 5 years prior to the French Revolution. And at that point, there was a lot of dissension against the French monarchy, particularly Marie Antoinette. But this came about that there was a sort of like embittered noblewoman that had had her land and title taken from her by the monarchy. And she wanted to get even with the Queen. And so she kind of concocted this deal whereby she convinced the cardinal to buy this fabulous necklace worth about, well, it would be worth millions of pounds nowadays. And she got hold of it, broke it up, and sent it off to England. And unfortunately, Cagliostro got drawn in because he was good friends with the cardinal. So it was a bit of a mess all round, and he got taken to the Bastille and was put on trial, but eventually found innocent. So, of course, he was a hero amongst the ordinary people, but had become a bit of a pain in the backside as far as the bourgeoisie and the monarchy were concerned.
And it really did a number to his reputation. I know in just a little bit of the research that I've done, it seems that there's a constant reference back to him as this charlatan. If I'm not mistaken, his secondary name, I guess, was Balsamo. Is that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is something that we came up against in the book, and we didn't really want to focus on this too much because, to be honest, it's so difficult to prove either way. We came to the conclusion in the end that if he was Balsamo, who was meant to have been this Sicilian charlatan forger and general sort of bad guy, if he had been him, he changed completely. And from where our research took us, it was actually Freemasonry that probably brought about this sort of miraculous change from supposed charlatan to benevolent friend of humanity.
It was an interesting tale in reading through it, and I have to say some of his early existence was almost dreamlike in the sense of his connections early on, and maybe tell us a little bit about Cagliostro, and I'm probably totally mispronouncing his name. Of course, I have that tendency here. Cagliostro, tell us a little bit about his history. I mean, where did he come from? He was a bastard son of a noble?
Yeah, I mean, from his actual memoirs, the story goes that he was orphaned at a very young age and brought up by a tutor and several servants within the homes of various noblemen. They think that possibly he was born in Malta, but they moved to Medina and Mecca. He was brought up by his admission as a Muslim, and his teacher was reputed to have been an amazing philosopher and alchemist, and effectively taught Cagliostro the arcane sciences of Egypt and, you know, the East and everything. Basically, he then traveled with his tutor. They went to many different places, Egypt being one of them. They recorded that they actually went to the pyramids and that they met some priests who still held the ancient Egyptian teachings, possibly took part in initiation in the Grand Pyramid or the Great Pyramid. And then they moved on. They went to Malta and became great friends with Grandmaster Pinto, the Grandmaster of the Knights of Malta, set up a alchemical laboratory and were taught many things. His tutor, unfortunately, died there, and then Cagliostro decided to travel throughout Europe with Chevalier d'Aquino, who was, again, another big prominent member of the Knights of Malta. So then he went to Rome and met his wife, or future wife, Serafina. And it kind of went from there. Then they traveled throughout Europe themselves.
And maybe even as some intrigue to mention, his beloved wife, who actually factored very prominently in the story of his development of in the book, ended up being his betrayer, too. And I don't want to give too much away on that, but it seemed that he had a controversial, to say the least, existence in the overall sense. And it's unfortunate there's not as much history to it that I guess we so often look for trying to validate these stories. A few moments ago, you mentioned that writings of him, for the most part, were in the negative. And I'm curious, who was it that you found in more recent documentation and more recent writings were some of his champions?
Yeah, it was W.H. Trowbridge and Henry Ridgely Evans, who had a very different slant on him. I think they could actually see the really good things. And this is one thing, again, that we wanted to bring out within the book, is that if you look deep enough, he did have a lot of people that were very complimentary about him. There were many letters that I found in the British Library that commended him on his charitable work, said that he was basically an all-round good guy, and that he took these letters with him, or they were sent to other dignitaries in other countries to basically welcome him to the part of the world where he next went. And this is often really overlooked. And I think in the context of the era, you have to sort of, like, understand that the people then were completely different. I mean, you had to be someone to be someone, and he was a real peacock of a man. I mean, to actually get anywhere and do anything positive or to do anything that would gain reputation, good or bad, I guess, you had to be quite a prominent character, and he certainly fulfilled that role. But, I mean, there was a lot of other guys strutting around Europe at that time, changing their name and you know, being terribly flamboyant. So it wasn't anything that unusual. And I think a lot of people now pick up on it and say, oh, well, you know, he changed his name. Who was he? He wrote these strange memoirs that have a, you know, slightly surreal feel to them. But, I mean, if you look at people like the Comte de Saint-Germain as well, his history is very similar.
I was going to mention him in the sense that even at one point in the book you make a mention that there's some speculation that the two were the same, that Germain and Cagliostro were one and the same, just in name changes.
Yeah, I think there's also quite a lot of analogy that you can put together with these characters from that era. And their history kind of intertwines because I have some evidence that Cagliostro probably wrote something that Saint-Germain has been accredited for, and it actually puts a completely different slant on Cagliostro's, you know, sort of credibility, because if he did actually write this particular work, it is something that people have been marvelling over for centuries. And as being from Saint-Germain, obviously it seems to have been accepted a lot more readily.
What was this? What is this piece? Is this something that many Freemasons would be familiar with?
It's the Holy Trinisophia, which is an alchemical treatise. But from my research, it looks fairly obvious that it was written by Cagliostro. But I've still got to work on that. That's a work in progress.
It actually sounds like a book to follow.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
No, we could have, seriously, there's more material that I could quite easily write another book or two or three on the subject. He's a fascinating guy, absolutely amazing, really.
I really enjoyed the book, and I had a chance to read it quite some time ago, and have found it coming up in different communities that I belong to, mainly online, but just in talking about different things, that it came up frequently in different Rosicrucian groups also, that there's a definite connection to him, and there was a lot of bias in the sense towards the book that it wasn't about, you know, these ideas of Rosicrucianism, that it was more about Masonic, and so of course they took it as a bias that way. But really the book had something very specific about it, and something very specific in its extended name, which is essentially the Egyptian rite. And the book actually contains the initiations of the rites themselves. And this is the document you referred to a few moments ago. Tell us a little bit about that. What exactly was this Egyptian rite, and how did it come to pass?
Okay. The Egyptian rite is effectively a path of spiritual alchemy. If you go through the ritual in detail, you can see that it actually passes through the three stages of alchemy. Then the nigredo, blackening, the albedo, whitening, and the rubedo, reddening, which is kind of like, you know, the three steps you go through to perfect yourself to reach the spiritual gold. And again, it was quite bizarre because we weren't expecting anything like that. We didn't really know what to expect. And obviously, it was written in 18th century French. And mine and Bob's sort of school day French didn't quite cope with that. So we had it professionally translated. And it was only, you know, when I first saw it, I thought, wow, we've got something really special here. I think what Cagliostro was trying to do with the Egyptian rite, he was not trying to replace regular Freemasonry or anything like that. He wanted to enhance it, perfect it, and allow people to take it that little bit, well, quite a lot of it further. You had to be a master mason in regular Freemasonry to then go on to do the Egyptian ritual. And it took some time. I mean, It wasn't something that you could literally rush through. It took 5 years from apprentice to companion, and 3 years then from companion to master. So it was definitely not a flim-flam ritual, which a lot of people have actually said, oh, you know, it's just gobbledygook, it's rubbish, but it isn't at all. It's a serious alchemical hermetic path.
It just in reading it and my interpretation of it, it almost seemed as it was a transition over into a monastic experience. You were going from this regular third degree Freemason of the era into essentially a monk of sorts doing this alchemical study. The periods of time that they set up for this for the further degrees, just in reading it, seemed very extensive. Did you find that in the writing of it?
Yes, I mean, again, we were quite surprised that it did turn out to be such a prolonged path for the Mason. I mean, obviously, nowadays sometimes people can go through the 3 degrees very, very quickly. But I think with this, because it was focusing on alchemy and the hermetic path, that it was something that had to be done the right way. I mean, it wasn't completely monastic in the sense that they cut themselves off from the world, but they certainly had to do an awful lot of work. They had hours of meditation, hours of prayer, and hours of practical alchemy and hermetic teachings in between, which obviously didn't leave an awful lot of time for anything else. So I guess it was pretty much geared up to those people that did have an awful lot of leisure time. So the more sort of wealthy, perhaps.
Just in the ability to have that meditation time. That was one of the things that struck me, and I think that's why it seems to have branched into these other channels, the Rosicrucian or other metaphysicists. In that it demanded, if you will, such an extensive degree of meditation, of experimentation and meditation, and this rigorous process of how you advance in degrees. I'm curious, in your research for it, did you find that many people went through these degrees?
Well, to be honest, we found no evidence of anyone having mentioned that they had. Obviously, because Cagliostro's records were all destroyed by the Inquisition, we don't have any names particularly of those that were involved in the rite. I believe it has continued and still continues to this day in France and some other European places, but it's not something that's been, you know, sort of made particularly public.
Do you think that it's still a, for lack of a better word, a sub-Masonic order, or
yeah,
a separate order in and of itself?
Yeah, no, it's a irregular Freemasonry group still going, which I think is great. You know, the fact that it has lived on, and with the book, what we wanted to you know, put over is basically say, well, you know, this isn't just a historical sort of novelty. It is actually something that has been done, that is still being done, and can be done again. And the great thing about it is that it does involve a lot of different things. There is a heavy Rosicrucian element in there, but it also relies heavily on the alchemy, the hermetics, Kabbalah. So it appeals to quite a range of people. I mean, we've had some really amazing feedback, and there has been a rather strange sudden run on people buying it from Great Queen Street in London, which is where the Grand Lodges, and they've had a sudden run of a certain group of people, obviously Masons, but they're not quite sure which order or anything they come from, but they all seem terribly interested in it. So whether they're going to revive it We don't know.
It did strike me as interesting, and I'm curious, how do you see this in light of the Memphis Mizrim? I'm sure in the process of your research for it, you've come across that, which itself pronounced itself to be an Egyptian rite.
Yeah, I mean, there were quite a few of them about at that particular point. I mean, there was the Kroterapoa, African architects, who all had fairly similar stuff going on. I think basically what it is that there is this universal wisdom that has been passed through, and Freemasonry as a concept, I feel, I mean, obviously I'm not a Mason, but I have a very deep love and respect for it, that I feel that it has been around, you know, probably since the dawn of time. The actual principles of it are very similar to the principles of Maat in the ancient Egyptian society, you know, the whole thing of equality, balance, truth, order, justice. And that seems to have ricocheted down through the centuries, and obviously there were many different texts that were translated around about the time of the Renaissance, which these people would have read and come to their own conclusions from. But this, you know, sort of fantastic ancient wisdom trickled through and infiltrated into all these different side orders. And obviously we still see a lot of that even in modern-day Freemasonry.
It's definitely one of those veins of thought that don't get explored too often. One of our past guests, Timothy Hogan, we were talking about briefly before the call, he wrote an interesting book about it that really went into that exploration. And one of the troubles that we find is that there's not a lot of concrete linkage to it, that these ideas are there, but no one can quite ever put their finger on exactly from where they came. And that's what's interesting about this rite, is that in some sense that Cagliostro, he seems to have brought this into it and tied the two together dramatically. Something that struck me in the book was a speech that he gave in front of a lodge talking about and defending his rite. I don't know if it comes to mind just offhand, but I mean, he goes through extensively bringing up Hermes and Thoth and Egypt and really deriding him for the Hiramic legend, saying get back to what's normally here.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the speech you're talking about was at the Masonic Convention, I believe, in Paris.
Yep.
They kind of ordered him to come and explain himself because he'd set up this rite and it was becoming very popular. And he pretty much blew them away with this amazing speech. And afterwards, you know, they were all kind of, wow, this guy is the real deal. And I think with the whole thing with the Hermetic path is that it has gone through so many different religions and so many different paths to manifest. And I mean, you have to remember, this was before the Rosetta Stone had been deciphered, so the fact that they knew so much about ancient Egypt at that point shows that there must be grains of truth in it. But there'll always be speculation, and I mean, this is a great thing, and it's actually a real pleasure to look into. And you know, you're going to get people who are going to say, "Oh, it's a load of rubbish," and then there's other people who are more open-minded that are going to say, "Well, wow." Wow, yeah, I can see that. And Timothy Hogan's book, I mean, is actually a fantastic little book. And I was really quite amazed when I read it, and the actual comparisons between the alchemical path and modern Freemasonry, and even, you know, sort of ancient Freemasonry, it's quite astounding. And there's a lot of stuff in there that you actually think, you know, you couldn't make that up. There's no way that you could. That is not a coincidence.
And that's actually an interesting little side journey there in talking about it, because prior to Cagliostro and his sense of where Freemasonry came from, in your book you go a little bit and talk about the William Shaw and his introduction, or I guess for lack of a better word, introduction of of this hermetic idea into the fraternity. I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit about that and what some of the conclusions that you found in the book were.
Yeah, well, I mean, Bob really looked into that heavily because, I mean, he's the expert on Scottish Freemasonry. And he was quite amazed to find that there was so much in the works around about the time of Shaw that implicated that there was hermetic and alchemical wisdom and teachings within, you know, even the early stonemasonry. So it's very difficult to say where it came from or whether this is right, but, you know, if we can put forward the principles that, you know, that it is a good and positive force within Freemasonry, if it is there, you know, we really did want to point out that, you know, it's not anything bad. It's a really good thing that is within Freemasonry. Hermeticism has always been a very positive force for mankind. And this is what Cagliostro was trying to achieve, effectively. He desperately wanted to help everybody, and I think that got right up everybody's nose. So, if you're a sort of tall poppy, someone's going to cut you down.
Well, and actually, I would like to get into that a little bit and talk about his ultimate end, his just desserts from the era. But before we go there, in this idea of Shaw, and it seemed to me important in the book that this establishment of these ideas of Shaw and his work in Freemasonry and weaving these ideas into it, not so much with a absolute outcome. And this is the hypothesis of the book in the sense of how these ideas may have been picked up by Cagliostro. But he put these ideas into it that were to sort of promulgate these ideas forward without an explanation necessarily, without saying an absolute this is what it is, but more of just this is how it is. And this is the way forward that we go, with no real explanation as to what exactly all that meant. What the hermetic ideas meant, and it seems to me that this is what Cagliostro picked up on, that it was these ideas in Freemasonry itself that lent him to compare it with the rites that he alleged that he went through in Egypt, and then move forward. And I'm curious if that was the outcome that you saw as it came putting the text down.
Yeah, I think from what we can gather, the inspiration did. For Cagliostro came from Freemasonry, and it, you know, coincided with his love of Egypt. So he obviously saw something in there that, you know, seriously rang bells, and he thought, well, you know, this is one and the same thing. As far as he was concerned, you know, it all did come from the same place. And I think the fact that there is evidence, you know, over the sea in England and Scotland, that there were inklings that this was already being looked at or was obviously there within the masonry of Shaw and his contemporaries, you know, to people like Cagliostro, they'd sort of come home when they got into Freemasonry, and they wanted to take it from there and make it even better. They wanted to sort of take it a notch up from it being what they saw perhaps as just a social club for gentlemen and bringing it into a spiritual role where they could become, you know, perfect men, not just good men, but perfected men.
Take the rites one step further and put them into practice.
Yeah.
Now, and we just mentioned jokingly a moment ago, about his end, and linked to that end was the Catholic Church.
Oh, yeah. It was not good. I mean, again, we found out an awful lot more about it when we researched into things. Obviously, he made the biggest mistake of all, and that was returning to Rome. His wife wanted to go back to her family, and he agreed because, you know, he obviously wanted the best for her. When they got back to Rome, they obviously we had no specific job or anything going, so Serafina not wanting to live a sort of lesser life than she had been living while she was in Paris and London, convinced him that he needed to get out there and do something. So, of course, he did what he did best, and started healing and setting up his Masonic Lodge. And, of course, in Rome at that point, Freemasonry was outlawed. So he was treading a very dangerous and fine line, and obviously we discovered that although it was implied that the Catholic Church picked him up on the fact that he was running a Masonic Lodge, they'd actually had their eye on him for quite a while. Effectively, I mean, yes, he was a heretic from the point of view that he was going against the Catholic doctrine, but they seriously had it in for him, I think, because they felt that he had something very special going on. He was basically purporting to teach people how to become divine or perfected without a priest, and that was heresy. So anyway, they had a special meeting, and he was arrested along with his wife and his secretary, and they were taken to the fortress of San Angelo in Rome, and encouraged to confess everything, which obviously you understand by my encouragement, my term encouragement, that they were tortured.
It was extensive time at that point, needless to say. I mean, this is still around the periods where papal bulls were issued against Freemasonry, and the Illuminati scare was fairly rife. And just in thumbing through the book, it was 1789 when he was picked up. So it was when there was a quite a bit going on with the Catholic Church and their dominancy, I guess.
Oh, absolutely.
For lack of a better word.
Yeah, I mean, I think... Well, I mean, they weren't... We wanted to kind of use the word scared, but they weren't obviously scared. They were concerned because, I mean, obviously they did not like Freemasonry and had it completely outlawed throughout many of the papal states. And obviously it was a offence whereby that they would deal with them sufficiently. But... There was also so much hypocrisy because there were a lot of Masons who were, in fact, Catholic at that point, especially within Rome, and many of them did a runner as soon as Cagliostro had been arrested. I mean, there were links within the Knights of Malta, and they were a Catholic order as such. And obviously, several of their members were Freemasons as well. So it's a very odd situation, and they were very focused on his Egyptian rite. Not happy.
It seemed like they, just from what I gathered from reading it, that it was extensive, that they really took great pains to make sure that this individual was particularly suppressed. And I wonder if that was their fear in the sense of what he was teaching, or just their victim of Freemasonry to be able to take it out on.
Well, I think it's probably a bit of both. They obviously wanted to make a very big example to Freemasons to basically say, this is what we're going to do if we catch you. You know, we're not going to tolerate this. But they did very much go into detail regarding his rites. They even got theological experts in to decode it or go through it to see exactly what it involved. And, I mean, obviously, from their point of view, it was incredibly dangerous to be able to offer the profane a way of spiritual enlightenment, because it was their job as far as they were concerned. So, obviously... he was doing something completely against their doctrine. But we do think that there is a huge element of, Masonic persecution within there as well. So I think it was just the absolute perfect fish to catch.
and at that point in time too, he was celebrating some notoriety in Europe, having had this issue in France finally resolve itself, and him still being not a household name, but a name nonetheless in France, a significant name of interest. That he was one of our galleries saying, ripe for the picking to be the whipping boy for this. And this was extensive, and I just emphasize that in the sense of his imprisonment and the years that he spent there. And he built up a bit of a reputation even from prison, it seems.
Tell us
a little bit about that. How is it that he, from prison, that he became this legend of the countryside that they feared revolution to free him?
Well, I think basically, obviously, he was kind of a leading light for people to rebel and try and get over there to release him because, there was a lot of Freemasons that were particularly unhappy with the situation. He had a lot of followers and a lot of people who, really did love him, who also wanted to get him free. But while he was in prison, he used to shout prophecies out the window. And the people in the village heard them, and they were absolutely convinced that, he was an amazing sorcerer. And whether he did it to wind up the guards or not, I don't know. But he certainly wound up the governor, and he wound up the papal council as much as possible. Again, probably not intentionally, but just through his very sort of being.
Pip, does that mean that he was one of the first evangelists, the TV evangelists? This is the precursor to TV evangelism?
I guess so. I mean, he used to certainly stand up and, he wasn't backwards about coming forwards. Let's put it that way.
I've been so quiet for so long, I had to act up somewhere, Pip.
I guess something too is that this prophecy that he was making to the countryside wasn't something that was new. He had a bit of experience in throwing these sort of prophetic pronouncements out of people, and they ironically had a means of coming true.
Yeah, he was an amazing prophet. Many of the things that he prophesied did come true. And again, that was used against him, obviously, because some of these were prophesying the death of the King and Queen of France. He prophesied that the Bastille would be pulled down. That's what he actually said, that he would only come back to France if the Bastille was pulled down and a promenade set up in his place. But of course, everybody took it as meaning that he was threatening them with this prophecy. But he had an uncanny knack of being incredibly accurate. He foretold the death of Maria Theresa, the Queen of Austria, and also with several of the dignitaries in Paris. He was so accurate that they refused to ever see him again because they frightened him. They were really frightened of him. But he used to have these fantastic seances whereby he would invite seven people to come and sit around a table, and there would actually be 14 chairs, and each guest would choose who they wanted to have dinner with, and as long as they were in the other world, they were a good invited guest. So people used to boast of having had dinner with Julius Caesar and various other ancient luminaries through Cagliostro's amazing ability to conjure people up. He was a fantastic healer, alchemist, and prophet, but obviously not to everybody's liking.
Not in the end, at least.
No.
And he even up until his end, was, in some respects, I got a sense that almost the church was frightened of him, that they didn't want to let him free or even let him have word out to anybody. So they took him to some extent as a threat. It was my interpretation of it.
Yeah. That was the impression that we got, is that they were incredibly concerned about the fact that somebody may come and free him. But I think they were actually scared of him in general. I think they truly believed that he probably was an incredibly powerful man, you know, spiritually. And yes, they did everything they could to keep him in his place. I mean, they took him right out to the papal state of Urbino in Tuscany and put him in the most horrendous fortress there. And he was kept in absolute, you know, sort of squalor in some respects. I don't think they fed them very well. That was one thing they did do, right? There was reports of him having his wine and his meat and things like that, but they treated him incredibly badly, and the governor of the prison was absolutely terrified of him. But unfortunately, when he died, we don't know quite where he was buried. I mean, that's another thing that I'd very much like to look into. Is that he was unceremoniously sort of dumped in a pauper's grave. And rumour has it that when the revolutionaries arrived, they dug him up and drank wine from his skull as a toast to his magnificence, which I'm not quite sure about that one. But that was Napoleon's troops who turned up and demanded to know where he was, and when they were told that he was dead, they found his corpse and dug him up. But whether that's true or not, or a bit of an urban myth, I don't know.
It all lends itself to that mystery of his past, and I guess important to note, and surprisingly, the actual finding of the Egyptian rite itself was a bit of a surprise, as none of his effects were let to go. They were busts that were commissioned of him. And he had a, for lack of a better word, a treasure trove of information that they collected over the years and carried with him.
Yeah.
And then upon his arrest and demise, all these things evaporated.
Yeah, they were burnt in the square when he was condemned. I mean, he was originally condemned to death, but that was commuted to life imprisonment by the Pope himself. So what that says, we're not quite sure, but yeah, I mean, the manuscript that Bob had in the library was actually recovered from France by a soldier and surgeon who's also a Freemason called Charles Morrison, and he brought back a fantastic amount of manuscripts and documents and books, and on his death, his widow donated them to the library at Grand Lodge in Scotland, and I was lucky enough to have a really good look through them, and there's some fantastic stuff there. But it was through his, you know, sort of amazing sort of gathering skills of going around the lodges that had been sacked by the mob in Paris that we actually got hold of this. So it's quite by chance, really, in that respect, because pretty much everything else was destroyed.
And one of the things that I found disappointing but understandable was that there wasn't much talk about what the time in between the degrees really spoke about. That there wasn't any explanation of the experiments or the processes or what the attainables were. Just the rite itself is just about the actual conferral of the degrees. Have you found any mention of any of what took place in between that, or is it did it all die with him?
The only thing that we found was his two quarantines, which were the two sort of rather interesting operations that the Masons would be put through at certain stages. One whereby they would be sent off into a house of contemplation and put through various tasks and obviously did various rituals and things. And the other one was the regenerative quarantine, where they went off into the woods for, I think, it was 40 days, and effectively took many different herbal preparations and supposedly the elixir of life, and rejuvenated themselves physically and spiritually. And I mean, they're pretty punishing things to go through. Whether, again, we don't know of who actually completed them. I mean, you know, this is the kind of thing that we'd love to have found out. But as to what they did in the laboratories that were actually assigned to the temple, we don't know. And I guess, you know, hopefully we might discover a little bit more at some point. But again, that's probably another book.
Down the road. In one of our viewing audience, they're asking, he died in prison, did he not?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he died of apoplexy. I think he literally just, you know, sort of had enough by that point. He was, from all accounts, he'd become mentally very weak as well. He used to call for his wife. You know, it was quite pitiful to read a lot of the notes about how he lived while he was in prison. You know, it was really quite sad. And at the end, the church completely denied him a proper burial or anything. And they said that he died miserably, just as he was born miserably and lived miserably. And that he died of a hardened heart, which was their sort of way of basically saying that the apoplexy was a physical manifestation of the fact that he was unrepentant. so it's all quite, you know, it's quite sad. I mean, I've got very, very attached to the dear chap while I was doing the book. You know, I mean, we really wanted to portray him in a much more positive light, and hopefully we did do that. And perhaps people will take him a little bit more seriously now and see that he was a very clever and learned man, and that unfortunately he really became probably one of the first Masonic martyrs in a way.
How old was he when he died, Pip?
56.
Well, not terribly old.
No, not really.
Young by today's standards, but yeah. I'm sure in that lifestyle, that was a gentrified old man.
Yeah, that was quite reasonable innings, I suppose.
and he was extensive. He literally was across Europe. And you know, we look at it in this time frame that it was so long ago, but I mean, this is really the period of the French Revolution, the American Revolution, and the establishment of America, and all these other transitional things going on. So he was out and about and abroad in a period of time that there was a lot going on. So there was a lot of movement, even up to the development of the French Revolution, Napoleon.
Yeah, I mean, he knew Ben Franklin. He was rumored to have healed him during a trip to Paris, and because of course Benjamin Franklin was a member of the Lodge of Nine Muses, so they all moved in those kind of circles, and yeah, I mean, they got about a heck of a lot in those days. I mean, travel was one of the sort of main priorities of the wealthy, really, was being able to move from city to city. Yeah, so it was an amazing time, obviously a very dangerous time, but it was incredibly vibrant and full of amazing people.
And here he is as one of them. It's sad to say that the extent that he's been erased from history. I know I came upon him in reading some of Manly Hall and some of Hall's earlier books and talking about him, just in this passing of his work. And it was extensive, just in his mention of him in the sense of his contribution to it, but yet there was very little mention of him further anywhere else.
That
was sort of wiped over. Anything that you think that we could take away today from the count? Any lessons from him then to bring forward now? That's sort of a daunting question, but...
Well, I mean, the main thing, I suppose, that we'd like to sort of put forward is that for people to perhaps find a little bit of spiritual gold within their Freemasonry and within their everyday life. You know, sort of always thinking that, you know, striving to be a better person. You know, we're not perhaps going to become perfect, but to do our best to try and live by the principles of Freemasonry or the principles of Hermetics, or just going that little bit to becoming a bit further towards being gold. So, you know, sort of reaching out there, doing something good for people.
It's a really great book. I really recommend it. Anybody who's listening, the book again is The Masonic Magician. Get the full title here. The Life and Death of Count Cagliostro and His Egyptian Rite. We have it up on our website at MasonicCentral.com. You can also find it on Amazon or go into Barnes & Noble and demand that they sell it. We encourage all of you to do that. If you ever go into Barnes & Noble, go in there and tell them that you want that book. So they'll order it and put it in their stores. Anything to look out for in the future, Pip? Any other books coming out?
Yeah, I've got a few coming out. I've got a handbook for the Freemason's Wife coming out in February, which is a kind of light-hearted but informative look at, you know, what it involves being the wife of a Mason, all the way through from, you know, so he wants to be a Mason right through to Ladies' Night, really.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah.
Don't publish that. Oh my goodness!
It's all good. Don't worry. It's great. It's a very positive slant on it because there's so much weird stuff, you know, on the internet from women that are so terrified by the idea of their chap becoming a Mason that we just wanted to put the kibosh on all the ridiculous myths and things. So I did that with another Mason's Wife. I've also got a book on meditation coming out and a book called The Quest for Hermes, which is a sort of really sort of informative book looking at where the path of Hermetics came from and where it is today. So, you know, right the way through from Egypt to now.
Interesting. I have a certain fondness for those sort of books. I expect a request for that one to come back on the show. I've been trying to get Dean into it more and more, and he's slowly starting to get there. All those actually sound very interesting, though. I think that's of emails that I gather and the different websites, the questions from the wives come in occasionally. It's something to look forward to. You have a hard time writing it? Was it fairly easy to answer the questions that seemed to come up?
No, it was fine, actually. I mean, really enjoyed putting it together because there was things in there that obviously, you know, even I hadn't sort of come across. I was actually quite shocked by some of the attitudes of people towards, you know, sort of the women whose husbands were Freemasons. You know, I mean, some of the websites, they were literally saying, oh, you know, you ought to divorce him. And I was thinking, my God, this is, this is totally out of order. I mean, we wanted to, you know, sort of put it right and sort of say, well, you know, they're not up to anything.
nothing too nefarious. I have to say, of all the different chat boards and message boards that I've been across, I don't think that I've ever gone out looking for any that ever talked to or had the idea of the wives on talking about their husbands going to lodge. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's really strange because there was a couple during the research, because we sort of logged on to a few places to see what kind of things were being said. And, I mean, it ranged from, you know, they're all Satanists through to, you know, you do realize he has to take his wedding ring off and therefore, you know, that's against the sanctity of marriage and, you know, he's forsaking his wife. And we just thought, you know, this is all taken completely out of context. and apart from being downright stupid, you know, a lot of the accusations that fly around, you know, for a lot of people, ignorance obviously is bliss, you know. I suppose you come across an awful lot of prejudice and, downright unpleasantness in the course of being a Freemason. I know it's quite rife over here. I don't know what it's like over in the U.S.
It's fairly much the same. It's remarkably it's a mixed bag of information. Even for Masons is what they know, even to what they can communicate. You know, the questions come across all the time of, well, what can I say, what can I can't say? There's a definite misunderstanding to it. And I've tried it with my wife here a few times to put on a show of Masonic wives. I'm trying to convince Dean to do it at some point.
Yeah.
To let our wives come on and talk a little bit about it.
The handbook may be the first step, Greg. Get the handbook out.
Yeah, you'll have to do an American edition for it.
Excuse me, I'm not in America. I'm not
North American edition. How's that?
Well, we've kind of included a few bits in there that hopefully will kind of translate across the pond. So, if the demand's there, then I'll have to get my publisher to look into that. Yeah, I'll send you a copy when it comes out.
That'd be great. Well, we'd love to have you back.
I think there's a niche market there that because they don't have, you know, they don't have a lot. I could almost see it being handed out almost mandatory in some places.
as a means to at least inform people. Pip, thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate you coming on talking to us about the book. I love the book, by the way.
Well, thank you.
I have a little bit of a biased opinion to it, but it's a great read. It's a great bit of history, and very well done.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me on. It's great.
Oh, our pleasure, our pleasure. It's very good to have you on. Dean, do we want to run the calendar real quick and just look at what we've got going on the next couple weeks?
Sure, Greg.
Dean's muted out. Did you have anything you wanted to throw into the fray, Dean?
Can you hear me, Greg?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, I thought you said I was muted out.
Oh, Weisenheimer. We're working on something for next week. Is that in the pipeline?
Yeah, we are. I think it's just to find details now, just to make sure that we have that he'll be here for sure.
Excellent.
And we've
had a lot of dialogue going on in the background, haven't we, about the next year? Some good things. What do you think?
Lots of stuff coming up next year. I think we have about 20 different ideas for shows. We're just going to put them together. If you have any other ideas, please, listeners, send them into MasonicCentral@gmail.com. We're looking at not only bringing in, you know, previous speakers we've had on already, maybe to rehash some other issues, but also to bring in some new speakers. New books coming on, and a few hot topics maybe to talk about as well. So hopefully we get a little bit of a break for the family on Sundays for a couple weeks, maybe at Christmas. We do have our Table Lodge idea coming on December 21st. That'll be interesting.
I pulled out my Table Lodge book yesterday, and I'm going to go through it now and figure out how we're going to do this thing.
Yeah, so you do that, Greg.
Hey, you'll be doing it right here with us. If anybody listening to this late in the show, if you're interested in participating in this, maybe send us an email and let us know, and we'll talk to you and we'll work something out. There's lots of toasting and lots of talking. There's going to be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to this. And
me too.
Yeah. So there you go. And then that'll be it for the year. So check us out, MasonicCentral.com. Email us, MasonicCentral@gmail.com. We have a calendar that will be blossoming soon with lots of stuff for next year. And I don't know, maybe we'll even see if Dean's be willing to run this ship for a few times. What do you think,
and
Dean?
What was I going to say? I was going to say, Greg, that if there's people listening, you know, they're looking for presents for other Freemasons, or to tell people that are looking for Masonic related stuff, we are putting all the books of people that we interview on our show in our Masonic Central website, and I think I'm going to be telling some people here to head there to look for some presents ideas, you know, because they have a hard time finding these things.
Absolutely, and these are good books. These are all excellent top flight books that we definitely recommend. I've read most of them, if not all of them. I think we're trying
anyway,
to get on
So, Greg, where are we going
now? I think we're done. we are going to wrap this up. So thanks, everybody, for joining us. Check out our website, send us emails, look for upcoming shows, and we will talk to you later. This is Greg Stewart saying. And oh, my God, this is Greg Stewart.
You almost forgot me. Oh, my goodness. This marriage is over. This marriage is history.
That's
Greg Stewart and Dean Kennedy saying.
Saying travel.
Travel light.
Light.